Good morning, Louise.
Good morning, Tracy.
How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
Really well. Great. It's been a great day so far.
So far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My daughter's gone off to school to do her discours in French today. So there was a lot of nerves in our household, I can tell you. But she knows her topic well because she's doing it about the art of color.
Oh, fantastic.
I know. So she actually listened to one of our shows to get some background information, did her research. It's really exciting.
Oh, that's great.
See how inspiring we are?
I love when that knowledge passes forward.
Yeah.
Yes.
It is very exciting.
Yes.
So we have a very special guest today.
We sure do.
Yes. Erin Leon is joining us. Hi, Erin.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
It's very exciting because Erin has an exhibition right now at the Art Gallery called Altered Landscapes and Objects of Indianness. It's two photographic series, and Erin has a fantastic process. It's a beautiful show. It actually vibrates with energy. It's so exciting.
It does.
Yeah.
It absolutely does.
And so we're going to talk a little bit about his process and the show and all kinds of topics. It's very exciting. Okay, so first, Erin, one of the things that first attracted me to your photographs was this unusual color separation that happens in a very subtle way in your landscapes. So maybe you can tell us all about the Altered Landscape series, why it started, how it started, and what your process is.
Okay. Well, the Altered Landscape series, I kind of got into that because I was really interested in how we can use photography to see things that the human eye cannot see. So as interested in like the infrared spectrum and things that are like right above the visible spectrum of like red, green, and blue color, like the whole rainbow system. So that got me thinking in just other ways we can see. And one of the ways that really interested me that somebody showed me was the tricolor process, where you expose the red layer, the green layer, and the blue layer separately. And it's kind of a reference to early color photography where they do that with black and white photos and stack those colors. And so you can see a little bit of a jarring when things don't line up. But in the process that I've been doing, I've been trying to really refine that so that the only movements in between the red, green, and blue create these like vibrant magentas, yellows, blues. And yeah, so let's go hiking and bring like, I don't know, my 40 pounds of gear with me and go to a scene and maybe wait there for an hour while I'm exposing each layer separately. Because what I'm looking for is, I guess, movements within the landscape that I can really highlight with this process.
Right.
Yeah.
And you've been all over the place in the interior here.
Definitely.
Like Maple Lake.
Over to Maple Lake, over to Revelstoke area.
Sorry.
Pretty much anywhere within like a 3 to 5 hour drive looking for different landscapes that are interesting and unique. And
yeah, and water is so good.
Definitely. So I've been focusing on waters and waterfalls, and yeah, they really showcase the, I guess, the process.
Yeah. Well, the, like I said, it vibrates. It's so interesting to watch. People examine it.
Shoot and point and shoot.
There is
point and shoot.
Oh, very much no.
And I think we've come to think that we're all photographers.
Yeah.
Because we all have phones and we all point and shoot. But it's important to remember that it's much deeper than the technical, like, the technical aspect of what technology can do. And sometimes in the arts, if the technology is developed that makes things easier for everyone, it actually makes it more difficult for the people who do it professionally. But would you agree? Or?
I would say people who get accustomed to a certain type of imagery, I think if you do take the time and spend the time with the camera and the landscape, that the image will regardless come out a lot better, I'd say.
Yes.
Yeah.
So just because you can take photographs does not make you a photographer.
Right. And it's all about different ways of seeing. So everybody sees differently. And so your photographs will be different from other people, no matter what. And yeah, and then it's just about taking those extra few steps in terms of process. And, you know, like you said about just examining different ways of seeing, examining color and the way we perceive it, that took you in a whole different direction. So the tricolor process, where did you learn to do that?
I saw it referenced from a couple of different photographers when I was going to school. And I was like, whoa, that's a really cool way of looking, because in photography, you're, I guess, playing with space and time. Like, you're taking a picture of a space over an allotted amount of time. And to do that with three different, I guess, wavelengths of color, I thought it was really neat.
Mm-hmm. And you were at Concordia, right?
Yep. I went to school at Concordia over in Montreal.
And fairly recently.
Yeah, I graduated 3 years ago, so I've been, yeah, back at home for 3 years now.
Yeah. And so do you find that the effort at, you know, like at a contemporary art school, in photography, like they're really trying to push boundaries because you don't want to just be another Ansel Adams, right? You have to find new ways of presenting this. So what kind of things were happening there?
People were getting really unique in pretty much everywhere with photography. Like, I wanted to go kind of like the experimental abstraction and color perception and explore that area. But a lot of people are doing amazing things in every aspect of photography there. The facilities they have over there just kind of allow that. They have like an amazing darkroom system, amazing digilabs, and yeah, really supportive staff and great teachers. So
wow. What a great environment.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
You must miss some of that being here.
Definitely. Like the whole, because a lot of my photography is based in film and darkroom. And trying to access that around here has been, well, it's been impossible. Even to get my stuff developed, I have to send it all over to Vancouver and wait for it in the post. But, yeah. It's really...
Not as much hands-on anymore, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So what do we need? A dark room? What do we need?
Well, a community dark room would be pretty neat.
Wow. Okay.
See? Makerspace.
Put that on the list.
Yeah. We were just talking about Makerspaces a couple of shows ago.
Oh, nice.
And what a great gift to our own community that would be for Canada 150.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Because then it's a, you know, like one of those grassroots things that everybody gets involved with, and then you can make it and design it for what you need. Oh, so if we need a community darkroom, we can get a community darkroom.
Well, we at least have to ask for it.
Yeah.
Right? And put it out there.
Absolutely. Okay, so the Altered Landscape series, you started when you were still in Montreal, right? Mm-hmm. And Definitely. Then you continued on here. So it spans those 3, 4, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I started in about 2013, kind of got a little bit of experiments in 2012, and yeah, been shooting that ever since.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
And then, so if it's okay, I'd like to talk about the other series, Objects of Indianness. Did you start that when you were still in school?
Yep. That was one of my earlier projects when I was in school. Around 2011.
Okay, well, tell us about that.
Objects of Indianness is kind of looking at, I guess, the appropriation that happens to First Nations culture and examining around that time. There's a lot of people talking about the appropriation of the headdress in mainstream culture and the problems that arise with that and different examples. I know A Tribe Called Red around that time was calling people out and banning them from festivals or like... trying to get them banned from festivals because it's appropriation, it's not too cool.
Yeah. And that was a big problem at festivals, wasn't it? Like, definitely. It seemed to be the sort of festival hipster aesthetic or something that headdresses became a big, all of a sudden, thing. So that was right around the time that you were...
Yeah, and kind of just looking at how stereotypes get appropriated and commodified and sold in mainstream culture and, yeah, how that affects... how it affected me, really, because being a First Nations person and not having, I guess, the First Nations skin, I've always, you kind of have to, you always get judged by the stereotype, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of seeing where the headdress comes in and seeing where I come in and, yeah, it's kind of going through the issue.
Yeah, an exploration.
Yeah.
For you as well as for... as well as opening a dialogue for your viewers, too.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And that's why I think it's, I don't know, it's a nice series to have around here. Because First Nations issues, I feel, need to be more of a forefront around the Okanagan.
Yeah. Absolutely. When I did a little bit of research about cultural appropriation, I had no idea how much appropriation has been going on, really with a lot of different cultures, but in Canada, for First Nations cultures, it's pretty prevalent. And the awareness just isn't there. I'm not sure that a lot of people really understand. And I had a sort of a concern about a couple of pieces of jewelry that I had even, because I was recognizing that Well, I've bought things that have had First Nations imagery on it, but buying that from a First Nations producer didn't necessarily make that okay, right? Just because the source was authentic doesn't mean that it's okay for me to wear that, for instance. So there was a lot of philosophy and articles that are talking about this, and it's kind of a brand new, I mean, it's not a brand new issue. It's been something that's been going on for, you know, several hundred years.
All day, every day.
Yeah, yeah, beginning with the appropriation of land and all the other horrendous history that we share. But just recently, the understanding that there are certain parts of First Nations culture that are sacred, that are like totally hands off, and other parts that are not so sacred that we can share and learn from each other with. So understanding the difference is a really big thing right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like the example that I had, it was the dream catcher, because you kind of saw those things everywhere for a while, right? Every kid in every classroom was making them, and you could buy them at the farmers markets from all different cultures. And I remember thinking, gee, what's the, you know, like, where's the line there? Like, who has to be making these in order to make this an authentic dream catcher? It seems to me that they're made out of all these different materials, everything from pipe cleaners to twine. And, you know, where's the line, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as it turns out, things like dream catchers are not sacred objects. They're, you know, it's important to do your research and be educated and understand what they mean. But because they're not a sacred object, they're not really considered hands off, right? Whereas the headdress is a very sacred object, and each feather in a headdress has a symbol and a meaning, and they're only given when there's accomplishment, you know, that the warrior has accomplished something or a deed, right? So in a way, they resemble medals, like war medals. Like, I wouldn't walk around with my Nana's war medals on my chest because I didn't earn them. And yet,
and here you certainly wouldn't sell them.
No.
Or sell versions of them.
Yeah. Like, would you wear a Victoria Cross?
I don't think I would, no.
No. And so why would we don a headdress, mm-hmm. right? It's the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Those are medals of honor, mm-hmm. and we did not earn that. And that's not our culture. So, you know, it's kind of, once you learn about it, it's so obvious. But, yeah.
So where's the pain point? Why aren't we learning that lesson? And what is the attraction to the headdress?
Well, I think because it's very beautiful.
Oh, definitely. It's very, yeah, you see a headdress and how can you not be in awe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the problem is when it becomes too much of a spectacle and it loses the original meaning and the original culture is lost and it just gets turned into a commodity that...
Yeah, I think it's the commodification of sacred items.
Yeah.
A lot of people wear crosses and have symbols tattooed on them and they don't know what the meaning is. I'm thinking of like Gaelic symbols or do we so just to play the devil's advocate, I often think we do that because we're searching for higher meaning. We just don't know how to, and the symbol is the easiest way to acquire it.
Yeah So it's so it's kind of a shortcut, maybe.
It's a shortcut.
Yeah.
You're not doing the heavy lifting.
Right.
Right? You just want to be associated to this Irish symbol or this First Nation symbol.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So I'm reading some of my little bits of research, and it bothers me that the legal term for First Nations peoples is still Indian. And I want to talk to you about that, Aaron. Like, how can we move forward with healing and reconciliation if we're using language that was mistakenly established in the first place? Like, how can we not, like, do you know what I mean? How can we get forward when we're still stuck in this past terminology?
That's a tough one. Yeah. I don't know, because legally we still are recognized as Indians. We have cards that say we're Indians. A mistaken term, yes, but we do have an Indian Act that does govern us. The changing of the label is, I don't know, it's nice, I guess.
Would you want it changed? Yes.
I guess so. For me, it's just another name change. I don't know. Even if you look at our own spell machine, that's been changed three or four times to Splatzin, to Splatchin. So it's just kind of something that happens a lot.
And I think it's important to remember that all cultures evolve.
Exactly.
And so
evolution is going to happen.
If there's a barrier at the point of which we have to say, well, we can't do this because of that's the way it was, therefore we can't do this now. So if we're always referencing the past, I think it's important to have the conversation, as you said, moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. I totally agree.
Yeah.
I mean, evolution is natural. That's what we do. We grow and change. We have to be willing to change in order to achieve any kind of reconciliation. So it seems natural mm-hmm. to change the terminology. It just seems normal.
Yes. In terms of defining what the boundaries are, though, within that forward motion, this is off limits. Whose responsibility is it to say this is off limits?
Yeah.
Well, right? Is there an education piece? Is there a...
Yeah.
Right?
Well,
and we all have our own personal cultural references. I know when I see someone wearing a hoodie with a big cross on it as a being raised Catholic, I think, why are you doing that? And then I think, why not do it? Why is his hoodie about me? Right? So I'm often challenging myself.
Right.
That symbol has now been appropriated to mean something else,
mm-hmm.
which maybe is okay. You know, maybe it's okay to let that history and the terrible bits of it go so that we can move forward.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. I'm just saying.
But there's a difference
between... I think we're walking on eggshells a little bit.
Oh, I know. This is a really
touchy
dialogue to have.
Nobody wants to hurt anybody on purpose.
Absolutely.
And ignorance is not an excuse.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. there you go, right?
Like, right?
And that's the thing about when, for me, I'm learning more about this all the time because it never occurred to me that yoga might be considered cultural appropriation
mm-hmm.
until I read about, how... The yoga practice is actually, it's being appropriated left, right, and center because people are just taking this active part, the poses, and then they're saying they have a yoga practice. Mm-hmm. And then there's yoga teachers. There's just white, blonde-haired yoga teachers out there that are not actually Hindu. They're not practicing yoga in the traditional form because yoga is a way of life. It's breathing. It's a way of eating. It's a way of meditation, right? Like, it's a whole existence.
Culture.
But... The difference is yoga comes from Hinduism. Hinduism is an open faith. With enough study and understanding and education, you can become Hindu.
Mm-hmm.
You can't become First Nations. Mm-mm. You can't study and then say, there I am, I got, and where's my status card, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like that. So there is differences, and we have to be aware of these totally, like an open faith kind of thing. Anybody can choose to be Catholic,
yes.
right? But can't choose
no, agree.
To be...
excellent. There you go. Establishing the boundaries.
Yeah.
That's an excellent, realistic boundary.
Yeah. So, actually, speaking of status
cards. It's not a club, and you don't get to join, right?
Your membership cards.
Oh, yeah. You do have cards. Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
So, that's a whole different thing. Status is a... Well, I don't know anything about that, so you might have to just enlighten us, Aaron. What is the big issue about status right now?
As in, what do you mean?
Well, as soon as I have a conversation with anybody of Métis heritage, there's differences with, we didn't do that but down east, my other cousin, they got status because of this and marrying into it. And it seems like there's differences with every area, with every region. And it does seem to be a little bit touchy that people love, that are almost 100% First Nations cannot have status, whereas a Métis that's 1/16th Métis could have status.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Métis system is a bit different than the status system, but that's been changing in the last few years where they're coming into saying that Métis can, they're trying to put Métis in with the status.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself is a big topic, but the status itself is federally governed, and that has changed over the years. At one point, you could marry into it, but no longer.
mm-hmm.
So the way you get status, I think, has always been federally governed, but I guess the benefits and what people think that people get is always up to the band itself. And yeah.
So regionally, there's a lot of differences.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is the boundary then about thinking about nations, like the Shuswap Nation, the Algonquin Nation, the Chippewa Nation? I mean, if we looked at it in terms of nations instead, does that make the understanding more clear? Because it seems to me if we thought about our First Nations neighbors as an actual nation and treated them like an actual nation, would that make things work better? Or
good question.
Do they?
Oh, definitely. It would give a lot more presence to people, and it would help, I guess, bridge the gap between communities, I'd say. Because a lot of times, like, the First Nations community is, there is a very big difference between the First Nations community and the non-First Nations community.
Yes. And even individual nations, there's big differences, right?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
You know, the concept of nation building is a dialogue we'll be having next year in pretty much every exhibition that we're offering at the gallery. And this is what I'm kind of hoping is that because we're celebrating Canada's 150th year as a nation as established by settlers, doesn't mean that we can't celebrate Canada as its, you know, 15,000 year history as a nation that's, you know, by the First Nations cultures. So I'm trying to make sure that every exhibition we have keeps that dialogue open and make sure that we're not just celebrating one kind of nation in, you know, in each exhibition.
Yeah, so it's a nation of nations.
It is, yeah. But that is the nation-building concept, because I keep coming across that term, nation-building, nation-building. Like, what is that? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking that that's an evolving thing, too.
Yeah, and right? And typically, Western culture is about the pyramid, you know, the triangle. There's someone at the top making all the decisions for people at the bottom.
Yeah.
But I think the First Nations traditions aren't like that. It's more of a circle, right? So, or that's my understanding. And if we're going to be a nation of nation, we really need to flatten down the triangle into a straight line so everybody has control, right? Because really it comes down to who's got the power.
Yeah.
Right?
I know.
And I think that this appropriation piece could be an element of power. So I'm taking your power by appropriating your symbol.
Yeah.
So that you know, right, so whereas in the Catholic Church piece, which is an open club, anybody can join, but sometimes people will appropriate that symbol to say, I'm taking this, I'm appropriating it, it's mine now, you can't hurt me with it anymore.
Mm.
Right? You don't get to use it in the way that you've used it.
Mm. Yeah.
That could be one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Well, and same thing with language, right? Like just what we were talking about, the old terminology, historic terminology, it changing. And there's been a lot of cultures who have taken back the negative terminology and use it in their own, with their own power. So they're taking the power away from the dominating culture.
Right. And so how do we, you know, stop the tug of war?
Yeah.
Right.
I know.
I don't know.
That's a good question.
Because I think it's insensitive. But I also think it is ignorant, and ignorance, you know, doesn't always come from a bad place. It just comes from a place of misinformation.
Yeah. So education has to be faster.
Totally.
Definitely.
or I mean, it has to be there.
Well, that would help, right? If it was actually built into the system. Like, I was actually talking with your lovely grandmother, Rosalind, who's just wonderful and made the most awesome bannock for the opening night. It was just the best.
Yeah, that was amazing.
It was so good. And then who was it that brought raspberry jam? I don't know. This raspberry jam showed up randomly. It was
Kathy Huska.
Oh, that was so awesome, too. It was just fabulous. Anyway, so
it was Miss Huska. She was my teacher.
Oh, that's so nice. So I was telling Rosalind that, you know, until I moved out west, because I grew up in Toronto, I had never met a First Nations person. In my school in Toronto, it was there was a lot of Jamaicans because that was kind of our area, and there had been a fairly big immigration of Jamaican peoples about that time. So, of course, all their kids just arrived, and there was probably two or three families of Chinese descent and a couple of Korean families. And that was, so that was our diversity, which is great. It was diverse, but I had not met a First Nations person until I moved out west. And so there was no, there's nothing in my schooling that taught me anything about the history.
Nothing at all.
Nothing.
Oh, see, in French school, you learned up to the Plains of Abraham and then that was it.
Yeah.
But in that knowledge was the relationship and the partnership between the fur traders and the Iroquois, the Algonquin, the right, the Chippewa.
Yeah.
So the narrative was all about partnership.
So that was interesting because then they kind of gloss over everything that happened in between first contact and now, right? Like, and that's my problem is that we're not even dealing with all of this sort of the last 50 years when we talk about First Nations history in the schools. So maybe there is some things about, you know, head smashed in buffalo jump, but there isn't anything about residential schools in, in the histories.
And that, I know that, I hope that will change.
I hope so too.
Oh, definitely. It has to.
And well, I think that's one of the recommendations of the, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Yeah.
That it be required part of the curriculum.
I hope so because my kids didn't understand what the 60s scoop was until we went and saw Tweetamus. Ooh, we should talk about that. So right before we go to break, I'm going to just say, so if you missed Tweetamus, did you see the play? This is where I first saw Aaron. He played Kyle in the Tweetamus play. It was fabulous. It was so emotional and riveting and also a very beautiful production because of using the natural environment and the characters and their masks and costumes and the puppetry. It was brilliant. So it was a partnership between the Blatchin First Nations and the Runaway Moon Theater, and they just did a really incredible job. So if you missed it, there's going to be a screening because it just so happens that when you film things for archival purposes, sometimes it works out better than you think. And so, Aaron, quickly, just before you go to break, tell us when and where the screening will be.
It's going to be April 19th at the community center. Get there around 6:30 because it'll start at 7 sharp.
Okay, so that's the Splatching Community Center. That is the very large, beautiful, amazing building that, I mean, it's worth going just to see the building because it's so amazing. Tuesday, April 19th. Show starts at 7. Be there between 6 and 6:30. Will there be popcorn?
There will be.
Okay,
wonderful.
And possibly Bannock.
Oh my gosh. Well, there you go. Okay. Thanks for that. We'll talk about more. Oh, actually, I'll have some of that information too on our website on the participate page. And we're excited about the exhibition that's at the gallery because Aaron has two photographic series, Altered Landscapes and Objects of Indianness. We also have a sculptor, Lottie Kozak from Falkland. And Lottie has a very beautiful, diverse heritage. On her mother's side, she is Haida and French, and on her father's side, Scottish and Mexican. So she gets to pull from a beautiful pool of cultural imagery. She does wood carvings. Actually, she does a lot of things, but what we're featuring in the gallery is her birds. It's a very large aerial installation of hummingbirds and chickadees, of all little hand-carved birds. They're just stunning.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice compliment because as we enter a dialogue about how we see things and how we share our stories, you know, it's really just good to pull in lots of different ways of telling stories.
Yeah, because sharing and stealing are two different things.
Yes. Thank you for that.
That was a very good point.
Yes. And so, but we need to understand, we all need to learn that, right?
Yeah.
And I think Aaron's work is helping us understand that better.
Well, hopefully it's opening up a dialogue because for me, I'm kind of scared of, because there's been such a history of cultural erasure in Canada through like things like the 60s scoop and residential schools, that when people's only reference to a culture is a headdress that's been commodified, that's where I'm really scared because people don't really know of the cultures within Canada. They just see the headdress or they see like some symbol or spectacle of a culture. And yeah, it'd be nice if there's just more, I guess, talk, more dialogue between people so that they know a bit more of like what the culture is. And yeah.
Like for instance, the headdress is mainly Plains Nations war bonnet, right? Like it's not all nations have headdresses, is what definitely. I'm saying.
And not all nations have totem poles.
Right.
And not mm-hmm. all nations have bannock.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so lumping this all together is the biggest as big a crime as the appropriation.
But is it done because it's practical? Oh, that goes in that bin. And this pierogies goes in this bin.
Oh, we totally do that.
It goes in that bin. And
yeah, we do that all over the place. We really like to categorize. It's mm-hmm. terrible. But that's part of the respect process, right? Is research, understanding, education, mm-hmm. to know that there is huge differences. Like there is mm-hmm. with East Coast. Gosh, like remember, you know, going to the East Coast, going to Newfoundland and thinking, did I even stay in Canada? Like, it's a whole different culture.
Yes.
It would be just like saying all Canadians are blah.
So you can appreciate another culture without appropriating. But appropriating, it seems to me, is about taking it without permission.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would that be a fair?
It's like cherry picking too, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you're for fashion reasons, for trendy reasons, or whatever, just cherry picking things that you like about other cultures, mm-hmm. that is appropriation. If you do things out of respect and education, like for instance, one of the articles I read was talking about whether you can dress up in a sari and bindi and, you know, and do all the things when you're going to an East Indian wedding. Because that's very normal, that's respectful, but I would not dress in any kind of First Nations regalia to attend a First Nations wedding, right? Like I would just show up in my nice dress. But it's a different, like you have to do your research and discover what it is that is appropriate in mm-hmm. that culture. And you would, in some cultures, you would dress appropriately to go to their wedding. Hmm. So it's a learning. It's just learning. You have to be willing to do the work.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so, Aaron, for visitors to the gallery who come and see the show, I know everyone will take something a bit different away, but if you could be whispering in their ear as they left the door, you know, what kind of messages would you want them to bring home with them?
I guess just reevaluate how they see First Nations cultures in their own community and stuff. I know most of that series was kind of based in Montreal, where you see a lot more of the tourism side and the commodification. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of just commenting on that. And yeah, I would just want the viewer to be intrigued by it, to question what they think they know about it, and to just go do more research and learn more about the culture, because that's really what needs to be done. What mm-hmm.
people. And that's where the real value is, mm-hmm. is not the headdress, but the story of the mm-hmm. headdress, not the feathers, but the reason mm-hmm. for the feathers, right?
Definitely.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And not the exclusionary piece, only First Nations people can do this, but more why it's this way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The caring and sharing.
Caring and sharing.
Well, it's
not
true.
Stealing and selling.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we've learned stealing and selling from our very own government. They, mm-hmm. they did it, right, with the, you know, with the totem poles, with all the little artifact kind of symbols that they appropriated early on and sold as Canadian souvenirs from the turn of the century, mm-hmm. right? Like,
well, merchants did that, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it goes
back in a way to the trading post.
But with no regulations.
No regulations.
Like even the Americans have a, what do they call it? The American Indian Art and Craft Act.
Yes.
So you can't produce anything that has any resemblance to anything Native American without it being produced by a Native American.
Yes.
And, you know, or saying that it is Native American if it's not produced by a Native mm-hmm. American. So, but we don't have that here in Canada. It's kind of self-regulated, which is not good because then, you know, corporations can do kind of what they want and mm-hmm. forgiveness later, right? And I just want to kind of point out the whole totem pole thing. So this is interesting because you said like not all nations had totem poles. It's true. It's a very coastal thing. And we've had lots of discussions about the Emily Carr kind of approach, you know, what constitutes appropriation when you're using it in your art and when, you know, when clearly it's not part of your own, you know, art, your own statement. But it was part of her story in discovering the coast. So it was. There's been a lot of conversation about Emily Carr.
Oh, I bet.
Oh, yeah. And in art school, it's really fun, too, when you get into these debates in the classroom. It's nasty. But yeah. It's one of those, one of the symbols that we probably most misunderstand about its true purpose, its true story. Like, we have a terrible saying, low man on the totem pole. Mm-hmm. And it really means, like, you're the least important. And yet a totem has nothing to do with who's most important at the top and the least important at the bottom, right? Like, it's a story. And a lot of people think that it's a family history, too. It's not a family history. It's just, we don't know anything about totems. And yet here we are picking them up, plunking them down in front of stores and in parks. and we got this one, and this guy made this one. And right? Like, they're just mm-hmm. everywhere. And we're not even understanding what they are, never mind what to do with them or how, what they mean. It's just really, that's very sad.
Definitely.
Yeah. I think it's worthwhile. Discover the totem pole. Learn about the totem pole. There's resources, lots of them, online and in books mm-hmm. to learn. There's a lot more to them than what we think.
Mm-hmm. And it comes back to the education piece, I think.
Totally.
But maybe you could tell us more about the daycare.
Yeah.
It's hard to change, you know, it's hard to change a leopard spots. I mean, I think for a certain generation, I don't know that we'll be able to turn this thing around. But if you think about the younger generation, that's really where the
that's opportunity where the power is, lies.
I think.
Definitely, especially within the schooling system.
Yes.
Especially when you have like a mandatory regulated school curriculum that you go through that glosses over a whole history of Canada. Mm-hmm. It's been, well, it's problematic. It's created a lot of problems we have within the communities. It's created a lot of unfair stereotypes, which is why, one of the reasons why I created this series was to explore that. Because, like I said earlier, when you are labeled with this Indian status card and you have these stereotypes and you go to schools and their only reference to a culture is kind of like the war whoop and the headdress. It's, yeah, makes you feel a bit weird about your own culture.
Yeah. Well, and it doesn't, yeah. And so tell us about then what's happening in Enderby.
In Enderby at the, in Spletchin, we have I work at the Spletchin Chemexultan, which is the teaching center. We provide childcare and language and culture. So in one of the programs that I'm working with, actually recording and using microphones kind of like these, we record some of the elders and their stories, their translations, their conversations, exploring some of the words and remembering some of the old words to kind of, yeah, help revive the language and help document the language and the culture. And then we also bring in the children. They get to hang out with the elders, the Kikia'a, and yeah, we teach them songs, we teach them different things about the seasons, what's around them. Yeah, it's really good.
Mm, that's beautiful.
Because that will bring the, that will revive the culture.
Definitely.
As opposed to appropriation, which can kill a culture.
Yeah. And we know too, just psychologically speaking, that when you have stories, when you have family history and you tell stories within your family, it builds self-confidence and self-esteem in children. So if your stories are constantly being told, you're going to raise healthier, happier people who will then tell the stories to their children, and right? And it just keeps going on. So the stories are so, like, they're the very backbone of this. Language is, I mean, it's one of the most interesting things I saw was when at the last Arts BC conference and the First Peoples Cultural Council was there, and they gave out these little booklets. One of them had a language map of BC. Have you seen that?
Definitely.
Yeah, and it's not pleasant to know this, but one of the terms they used for the extinct languages is a sleeping language.
Mm.
And at first I thought, oh, how lovely, a sleeping language. But then I saw what it meant. It's like, yeah, there's no speakers left. It's like, oh my God, it's devastating to know that it's gone.
Oh, it's very scary. And every First Nations community is facing this. Like, I know even with our community, we have very limited speakers. We have yeah, it's just really scary. Mm-hmm. We have very limited speakers, and they're all getting more elderly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, yeah.
So everybody's frantically trying to record as much as they can?
Definitely. I hope so. Yeah.
And is there a written record as well? Like, or is it only a spoken?
There was a linguist who came and made a practical writing system, which is based off the English language, and he used things like sevens for like glottal stops and stuff that aren't common in English, and make the Spletchian language and other Salish languages unique. So there is a written way to document the language, but it doesn't always make sense, but that's just the way it is.
Yeah, well, because if it's all about the stories and the sounds, it's really hard to translate that, right?
Definitely.
And then just writing it down doesn't make it speakable. Mm-hmm. Either, right? You have to hear it.
Yeah, because the written way is not really like English. It's a version of English that we use.
Oh, it's just like, I really see that your path ahead, you must kind of feel like you have so much to explore and to accomplish and to work at. It must seem a little daunting sometimes.
Oh, very much. Yeah.
It's a quest, not a hobby, that's for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a settler culture, we kind of set these goals and we're going to accomplish this and this and this. But for First Nations culture, it's much more on the larger time frame, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's not necessarily something you can do in 10 years. Maybe it's 3 generations, mm-hmm. right? That
will or take. As many generations as it took to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And now,
as the art world turns, a dramatic moment in the arts.
Well, as drama goes, fashion sometimes plays a role in when we talk about the dramatic moments mm-hmm. in the arts. Fashion is an art form.
Absolutely.
And we have noticed there's been a few dramatic moments over the last few years in the fashion industry when we're talking about First Nations appropriation.
And fashion is interesting because it's usually of the design levels, it leads.
Yeah.
Right? So it first happens in fashion and then it works its way. Then it goes to home decor. Then it goes to, right? So
yeah.
There's different levels. So to me, when these appropriation mistakes, or are they mistakes, are they intentional, happen in fashion, it's really sending off the flare that look, this conversation needs to be had.
Yeah.
And quite urgently.
Yes.
Right?
Okay, so one of the big ones, in 2012, Victoria's Secret sent Karlie Kloss down the runway wearing a full-length headdress and then a tiny little leopard skin bikini.
Mm-hmm.
And that set off a firestorm.
Yeah. Well, it's offensive, isn't it?
It's horrible. It is really unbelievable. Like, just basically, she's wearing pretty much just a headdress, like hardly anything else. And that is a significant company, a large company that absolutely has the resources to do their research and didn't. So Aaron brought up that very interesting point that maybe it's intentional.
There's a very big gray area in this issue of like whether people are doing it intentionally. And I think a lot of companies have been kind of using that to their advantage, because for a while, yes, maybe you could say people didn't know, people were just like using the headdress because it is an amazing look. Like, it looks awesome. But I think even lately, even more so lately, that a lot of companies are just using this bad PR, I guess, to their advantage, whereas they can appropriate the headdress, they can use it for a controversy, there'll be this big thing, but in the end it just gives them more press time.
Sure.
And they just have to write like a thank you or like a sorry.
We're so sorry.
A Twitter apology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. And then Urban
Outfitters. But you can't buy that.
Well,
you know, that exactly. Publicity, you cannot buy it in advertising.
It's true, yeah. Right?
I know. So is
and it, so it's strategic then.
Is it strategic?
Ugh.
Which
is disgusting.
It's doubly offensive.
It is.
Yes.
It is. So Urban Outfitters is facing a lawsuit right now over their, they have a whole line of Navajo designed wear. I mean, hello. I thought that would be pretty obvious too. You don't, I mean, it's just like the example in one resource I used. Would you take a Prada design and say, here's my Prada dress? Like, it's one thing to be sneaky about it and copy a design, but it's another thing to copy a design and then say, look at my Prada dress. We're not allowed to do that. So why would you even imagine that you would be able to appropriate a whole culture's aesthetic, not aesthetic, a whole culture's symbols, color schemes, designs, you know, all the things about the cultural icon about what they wear, and then use their word, like their name, their cult, their nation's name, Navajo. It's just insane that to think that they could get away with that. And it does make me start to think, yeah, why wouldn't they just come right out, do it, and then get all that press?
No.
That seems possible.
So they're gaming the commercial system. I mean, D-Squared did it too. Canadian designers who are designing the Olympic uniform, as it happens, for Rio. Huge controversy.
Yeah,
they call it the D Squaw collection instead of the D Square collection. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed.
Examples are like endless.
Yeah, it's true. Adidas did a horrible thing, like advertising campaign using the totem pole. A woman was basically totem poled with Adidas outfit, and then her shirt came when she lifted up her arms, made wings like the Thunderbird at the top of a totem pole. It was like over the top.
Right.
It's almost like, yeah.
But the sanctions don't match the, like in other shows we've talked about how culture, it built in culture is the our ability to sanction one another if we don't follow the rules.
Right.
And it doesn't necessarily mean it's a formal justice system. It just means as a society we have this reciprocity rule, whereas if you help me, I'll help you back, but if you hurt me, there you will be sanctioned in some way by the community, whether it's being ignored or not being invited, or right. And yet the sanctions don't match, because what do we do as a result of appropriation for commercial purposes? It amplifies their celebrity, right?
So right.
D Squared did this prior to being selected for the Olympic uniform.
Mm. So there's
it gave them, you know, that lift of publicity.
Mm-hmm. So there was no negative consequence for that.
No, or certainly not sufficient sanction to match the...
Yeah, we don't have a legal... in Canada to help support that.
And legal can be formal, but the informal piece is how we sanction each other for their behavior.
No, you're right.
Right?
It's absolute. Like, that's, we vote with our dollar.
Yes.
We vote with our feet.
Yes.
Right? Like, we have to be the ones. Mm-hmm. We can't wait for lawyers to figure this out. Right? And we have to do it faster. Like, we, it's so frustrating to sort of see, because I'm looking back at the last 10 or 15 years that some of these things have happened that feel very current. They feel very right now. I'm thinking, really? In 10 years, we have learned nothing?
Mm-hmm.
Like, come on. So.
No, we've learned. We've just not built in the sanction mechanism so that they know this is will be the consequence of your.
Right.
Right.
So what can be our
Which
sanction
the First
system?
Nation culture is very good at. Right? This will be the consequence for the harm you cause to your community.
Oh, yeah. It just kind of shows, like, the very big difference between communities and cultures,
yes.
I would say. And, yeah. I don't know. I don't know if one culture should decide for another culture what is right or wrong, but I think they should kind of approach the other culture and maybe see.
Yes.
So...
Well, it's one way of learning whether or not you're appreciating or appropriating.
Yes,
is by learning what is sacred and what is, you know, open and welcome to share. So that's an easy fix, right? Just do the work. To me, it seems easy, but the understanding of the sacredness, I think, is the key. That's kind of what I would want to sort of lay down at the end of the show here, is that we need to make sure that we're respecting the sacred. And we certainly expect that of other people in our cultures and maybe our religion or whatever else that we find sacred. We expect other people to respect that. And so that's a very simple law to follow, I think, in terms of a personal law.
And I'd like to add just two great resources that I used a lot for, I guess, research and stuff was, there's this great blog called Native Appropriations, which goes through and has a lot of articles dealing with, like, a lot of the up-and-coming and, I guess, current topics of appropriation and stuff. Like, even recently, they have articles on J.K. Rowling and her wizardry in North America, and they gloss over some of the First Nations histories and North American history. So there's some pretty interesting articles on there.
Yeah.
And then there's this movie called Real Indian, which goes over a lot of the appropriation and stereotypes of how Hollywood has used that to their advantage, which is just an amazing documentary.
Wow.
Yeah.
And because the truth is, we might not even know. I mean, like, I just looked up what the root meaning of the word appropriate. So appropriate, approval, appreciate. Appro means to approve. So in a way, appropriation is a form of approval. But who has the right to approve what, I guess, is what it comes down to.
Gets to cherry pick what's approved.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it is important, like, to be sensitive to those things on all
Hollywood
closed clubs and open clubs.
But Hollywood's been sort of, you know, the root of a lot of this because of the perpetual visual representation of the stereotype, right? Like in movies and...
And they celebrify what's unknown and what's misunderstood.
Yeah. But there's been so many cases of people of European heritage being hired to play First Nations people. And that's still happening. Like, that is the weird thing. After 100 years of Hollywood, that's still going on. And I'm sure you know, like, when I can't remember the guy's name I heard on CBC, after Leonardo DiCaprio did his little acceptance speech saying we need to hear First Nations voices.
Oh, and The Revenant? Yeah.
Yes. This guy said, you know, thank you, Leo, that was really nice, but if you really want to hear First Nations voices, you have to support First Nations filmmakers. It's not about just hiring First Nations actors to do the role. It's kind of the beginning. You have to actually listen to the stories and let them tell their stories in these new ways, and that's the voice. It's not about just hiring the right actor.
Well, if you want a true, you know, again, that word authenticity, and there's only one way to make something authentic.
Yeah, go to the source. Yeah, but it's just a way more complex kind of fix, right? Like, it's not a fix. I don't know. I'm just making up words here. I just want to say that it's a more involved topic. You know, you have to work at it.
It's a big topic.
It is a big topic.
It's big. It's going to take time. We need to talk about it
and
more.
And you need the intellectual rigor to think about it,
yes,
right, and to consider it. That's why the show is so meaningful to me. When I saw it before it opened, I snuck in. I like to do that.
Gets a preview,
and I was struck by the images, and you know, you're challenging us to think about this in a way that we aren't normally challenged. And I mean, we as in the general we, not like one culture challenging another culture. I hope that's a fair statement.
Yes, I think so. And dialogue, we're just talking about dialogue, right? We just need to talk.
We do.
Yeah.
And now we're at 2 minutes.
Yes, okay,
Speaking of talking, the engineer's waving his fingers madly. You have more things to say and you only have 2 minutes to say.
So come see us at the gallery.
Yes.
Come see the exhibition, and it's on April 2nd to 30th. Hours Tuesday to Saturday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. The artist talk, which Aaron is going to be at, is on April 21st.
Yes, don't miss that.
2 p.m. That'll be great. And anything else you want to find out on upcoming arts events can be found on our website, salmonarmartscenter.ca, on the participate page. We have a listing by date of upcoming arts events. So that's the best way to find out. And I'll put the Tuitamus play screening on there. So it's like a movie. You're coming to see a movie.
A movie of a play.
And again, talk about dialogue. That was a really important dialogue starter for a lot of people. So congratulations on that. And I'm glad that the screening is happening. An extra opportunity for us all.
And thank you for your work.
Thank you.
And all that you do. And thank you for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure. Okay, be sure to see Aaron Leon's exhibition at the Art Gallery this month.
And keep talking.
Yes.